This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to a very special joint episode of two shows that you hopefully love. One, The House of Pod. I'm Kaveh. I'm the host of that show. And It Could Happen Here with my good friend, James Stout. James, hi.
Hi, Kaveh. I'm very excited about this. This is a rare privilege.
Yeah, I'm very excited too. We'll get straight to it. Just a quick reminder, if you're not following one of these shows and you're following the other, yeah, follow both. Why not? Yeah, and yeah. Leave a nice review if you like the shows either way. But we're really excited. So let's get straight to the episode. How's that sound?
Yep, let's go.
Every week I say this is a special episode, and I'm usually lying. 99% of the time it's not special. But this week is very special. It's special because I've never done this before. I'm very excited. It's a topic I really have wanted to cover for a while, but I'm going to be covering the topic with a good friend of mine who has an excellent show, and we're doing a joint show release thing, and I've never done it. It's like a Marvel team up, and I'm very excited for it. James Stout. James, I'm going to introduce you first. Journalist, podcaster, host of It Could Happen Here, which if you're listening to this on It Could Happen Here, you already knew that. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I don't watch many superhero movies, so I'm now concerned as to which Marvel hero or villain I would be. But
I was thinking more of the comics, but if I have to pin you to a character, it's Moon Knight. I think that's clear.
Okay, it's gone straight past me, buddy, but I'm sure. I hope that was
my word for it. It's cool. Yeah. It's cool. James, can you tell us a little bit about what we're covering today? Let's talk to our people about what, and then we'll introduce our guests, but let's tell people kind of what we're trying to cover today.
Yeah, of course. So I think we're talking about like healthcare in an Indigenous context and how we can both like learn from and stand in solidarity with Indigenous communities when it comes to healthcare, I guess.
Excellent. And to help us with that, we have two guests. We have a medical student at a little school called Harvard. I think it's a liberal arts school out in the East somewhere.
Correct.
Named Victor Lopez Carmen. He was the prior elected co-chair of the United Nations Global Indigenous Youth Caucus. He is a member of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe and also from the Yaqui Tribe. Is that correct, Victor?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Welcome to the shows.
Thank you so much. I'm honestly props to pronouncing all that right.
Oh, yeah. No, your stuff I'm going to get right. Our next guest, whose name is Molly, I'm going to probably destroy her name because those are the names I have a hard time with. Dr. Molly Hallweaver, is that correct?
Correct.
ER doctor at UC Davis, one of my favorite hospitals in the world. Is that also correct?
That is correct. I work at UC Davis.
So I guess maybe we should start like, if we want to start out by explaining maybe how healthcare, like what things that when we look at healthcare in the Indigenous context, what things are we looking at that differentiate it from healthcare in other contexts, right? What would be the areas that both of you guys think that folks who aren't familiar with this, because sadly, I think a lot of the United States, they either don't think they know Indigenous people or maybe they really don't. And we can explain that lots of Indigenous people, most Indigenous people live off res too. I think that would be very valuable. But what sort of topics would we be looking at when we're looking at healthcare from an Indigenous perspective?
I think like when you look at Indigenous peoples in the US, you think of our traditional health system as well. Like that was what we always had. That was what we've had for thousands of years. And the efforts to maintain the traditional health, traditional healing practices. And then you look at the Western health system, that the different systems we have access to today, including the Indian Health Service, which is unique to us, tribal clinics, tribal operated clinics, and hospitals, everyday hospitals that anyone else uses. Because like you said, the majority of Native Americans today in the US live in cities or urban contexts.
Molly, let me ask you, because people may be wondering, how did you become involved with delivery of healthcare to the Native American population?
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us. I'm excited to chat with you all. I kind of had a unique opportunity. I've always been interested in Indian Health Service as like a healthcare delivery system and Indigenous peoples. And when I started fellowship, I did a global health fellowship and I started in 2020. So it was, you know, not a great year to be a global health fellow for many reasons. And so I had very, you know, obviously we were on lockdown and work was hard and stressful as an ER doc. And so we were trying to be creative in, you know, how we can do this global health fellowship. And so I got in touch with a awesome physician, Dom Maggio, who is the ED director at White River, which is a Apache nation in Arizona. It's like 3 hours east of Phoenix. So he went to he was a Highland alum, a Highland DM alum, which is in Oakland, and now works full time at White River. Anyways, got connected with him and everything that was going on during the pandemic, because as I'm sure you guys are all aware, and probably a lot of our listeners, that the Navajo and Apache tribes had much higher rates of COVID and of severe COVID. And so I went as first for kind of public health outreach. So I went and did some contact tracing and they did a really cool program of outreach in the community to go and check on the locals, and we would go and check pulse ox, so we'd see how high their oxygen saturation was and see how people were doing to try to catch disease early. So that's how I kind of got into doing it, and then I loved it there and wanted to keep working, and so I continued to moonlight, which means I worked kind of as a locums. I don't know if I need to explain that for medical jargon, Cave, but I worked, you know, every 1 to 2 months I would fly to Arizona and work on the res for a week.
Very, very cool. So Victor, getting back a little bit to where Native Americans are getting their health care, what is your interest once you're done? When you graduate from, where are you? What year are you right now?
I'm a fourth year, so I'm in my last year.
Oh my God. Wow. Good for you, buddy. How you liking it?
I'm liking it less. I'm not like I like medicine. I still maintain, but medical school, like I'm ready to be done with school.
You got senioritis, is that what you mean?
Pretty much, yeah.
Fair enough.
So you're a rising fourth year, or have you already matched?
No, I'm a rising fourth year. I'm applying to residency now. So
talk to us about where you'd like to go and what kind of medicine you'd like to practice.
Honestly, anywhere that will take me, because I want to be a doctor. But I want to go into pediatrics. Always wanted to help and take care of Native kids and back in the community for sure. I want to go back and be a community member again. I've been gone for so long. I feel like I've been only able to go back for, like, you know, breaks and things like that. And it hasn't been enough for me as an Indigenous person. So I'm ready to go back, be a doctor, be part of the community, be there for ceremonies, be there to treat patients. That's my ideal.
I think one thing that's really interesting, especially, and like we have this chance to talk to you, which we often don't have, is you mentioned like balancing like Western medical technology with Indigenous medical technologies, right? I'm really interested in hearing how you would approach that for folks who aren't familiar or for folks who don't have the knowledge of Indigenous medical technologies that you might, or you maybe have people who you go to for that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to just already start the conversation that so much Indigenous medical technology has already been appropriated by Western medicine as Western medicine. Aspirin, for instance, many traditional healing practices that were and are still find themselves seeping into the field of psychiatry or around parenting, mental health, the way that, for instance, that Indigenous peoples, I think there's a growing understanding in the medical field about planetary health and the impacts of climate change on health. And a lot of that has already been said and fought for by Indigenous peoples for a very long time. And so there's already a lot of stuff there that we're working with. And I think it's important to give Indigenous peoples their flowers. But yeah, I think when it comes to integrating on the clinical level, it's going to differ from community to community. You might know, but in the Pascua-Yaqui tribe, the health division employs a team of traditional healers that come up, I think, monthly from Sonora, Mexico, from the villages. And Yaqui patients can elect to see the traditional healers with or without a Western-trained physician. And there's a whole room where they have all these herbs and plants that Yaqui people have been using for thousands of years. And I think that that's very beautiful. One reason we've been able to do that is because our tribe elected to run their own health division rather than having the Indian Health Service run it for them. We had the capability to do that at the time. Not all tribes do have the capability yet. We had it, and I think it's been beneficial for us because it's given us more freedom to bridge Western and traditional medicine in a way that works for us.
The Yaqui system is a really great one. Like, people won't be familiar with it. I guess most people listening won't be familiar with it, but it's allowed the tribe to do all kinds of cool things. Like, I've been involved in a diabetes prevention cycling program there for 10 years, something. Nice. I don't know, long time. But there are things that can be done because of that block grant or running their own system as opposed to having IHS run the system. Could you, like, because Molly, I think you're more familiar with like an IHS clinic model, right? Would one of you want to explain the difference between the two of those for people who aren't familiar?
IHS versus
the Pascua-Yaqui tribe run their own system. I think they get a block grant. Correct me if I'm wrong, Victor. They get a block grant from IHS and then they spend that as they see fit.
Yeah, I can speak to the IHS side, but for me, this, and Victor, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of similar to the VA for medical doctors to understand, in that it's a set of money that the government sets aside for a certain population, and veterans for the VA and IHS for natives. But there's obviously a disparity between even those two. Like, per capita spending is way higher in the VA than it is on IHS. But it's a Western system, and all of the staff on the hospital, like the reservation hospital or the Indian hospital, are all employees of IHS. So they're actually kind of like federal employees. And we can kind of get into the weeds of it later, but there's, you know, a lot of turnover because it's, sometimes it's hard places to live. And they're young, they kind of recruit young doctors, and there's a lot of turnover for the primary care doctors. And then in the ER where I work, there's very few board certified ER doctors. So it's staffed by non-EM certified docs.
That sounds right to me. The only other thing I would add is that the Indian Health Service, it's predicated on what's called the federal trust responsibility that's built over, decades Supreme Court precedents, smaller court precedents over the years that I think a lot of them were based in treaties made with indigenous peoples. And basically this means that the government, because of the harm, the oppression, the colonization that has been dealt upon indigenous peoples across the United States, there's a trust responsibility for the federal government to sort of to do something about the lingering impacts. They have a responsibility to provide health services to indigenous peoples in the US. That was also in many of the treaties that were made with indigenous nations. And I think it does go over people's heads sometimes that that this is not a favor. This is not a gift. It's a responsibility based on centuries of oppression, and that responsibility is not fully being met right now because the Indian Health Service is severely underfunded. The way that the funds are appropriated is unique to government healthcare programs. The way the veterans, for instance, Veterans Affairs is appropriated is much more effective than the way the Indian Health Service is appropriated at the federal level.
It might be worth explaining here just briefly that not all tribes are federally recognized, right? And not all Indigenous people are part of federally recognized tribes. And how would that impact their access to healthcare?
Yeah, well, you know, federal recognition isn't perfect. It's a really arduous process. And not all tribes are federally recognized. For those tribes who aren't, they don't have access to those services. Like the Indian Health Service or the Bureau of Indian Education, for instance, and many other federal grants that Indigenous peoples and Indigenous nations can apply for or just automatically get. For instance, during COVID-19, there were specific funding allocated for tribal nations. Those tribal nations who are not federally recognized, they wouldn't have had access to them.
Let me shift gears a little bit here and get to a question that is, I think, going to be very difficult to answer. And it's one of those impossible questions because there's so many parts to it, I'm sure, and it varies so much. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the major health issues that you guys feel are facing Native Americans right now, and whether or not, if they are at all different from the rest of the U.S. population. And then we could talk about what barriers there are to care in that regards. But we'll start with you, Molly. Can you tell us from your experience working there, what are the major health issues that you feel may or may not be the same as the general population?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's very similar. You're seeing the same disease processes that you're seeing in the general population, but you're seeing everything's a little bit more severe, I would say. Like there's more, there's higher rates of the chronic disorders like diabetes and hypertension, and it's kind of more severe long-term effects of the diabetes and hypertension. And at younger ages, I think that was kind of what was most striking to me. You're seeing the long-term bad effects at younger ages. You're seeing alcohol use disorder is a problem everywhere in the United States, but on tribes, alcohol use disorder is much higher. And again, like it was honestly shocking to see 30-year-olds who had end-stage liver disease from alcohol use disorder. And I saw on some of the sickest people I've seen have been from my time there. Excuse me. So everything just is, you know, a little bit harder. And the reasons for that, as we can talk about, are like totally multifactorial, but are in line with poverty. Funding is a huge, like funding and poverty go hand in hand, education, and just the fact that, yeah, they've been oppressed for centuries. But yeah, I think it's at the end of the day, it was the same. I was seeing the same things that I would see at UC Davis, but I was seeing it on a more extreme basis, I would say.
Victor?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's important to note, to sort of say that these problems exist all across the US because there can be stereotypes associated with our health concerns, like that are attributed to the way that we live or our culture or just inherent to who we are. Like there's this prevailing, I think, notion that, I don't know what came first, but I think in the medical field, I still hear about it, like in class sometimes they'll say like Native Americans have the highest rates of diabetes or heart disease, but they won't say why. And it makes people think that, oh, like, are they just not catching on? Like, are they just living badly? And when you don't say why, it kind of, I think it creates a lot of ignorance and a lot of room for interpretation. So I think it's really important to talk about those background reasons. For instance, with diabetes, I think a lot of reservations, there's no access to one traditional foods, which have been, you know, through policy eradicated through government policies over the decades and centuries, and no access to healthy foods. These are food deserts. And at the same time, like Dr. Hall-Weaver mentioned, there's poverty. So if you're trying to get healthy food, you don't have, number one, it's not on the reservation. You might not even be able to afford it if you can get off the reservation. Not a lot of people have, you know, not everyone has a car or the ability to mobilize, you know, an hour and a half to the health food store. And so, you know, a lot of that's just one example of like some of the systemic reasons why somebody could get diabetes quite early. And there's also a lot of lingering trauma and mental health impacts that I think play into the high rates of alcoholism. A lot of, you know, in policy, there were some early efforts to try to, I think, to try to limit alcohol on reservations that we still see today. On some reservations, alcohol is entirely illegal on the reservation, but you'll still see businesses right on the border of the reservation just camp themselves there, right on the border, knowing that the population is vulnerable, maybe not knowing that it's because of the historical trauma and things like, but there's something there, you know. So there's still an aspect of being targeted there by something that you know the community is highly vulnerable to still to this day.
It's a really interesting point that you bring up, because I remember being in medical school and you sit in these lecture halls and they would bring up like Native Americans being a high risk for all these. It would be like one of these little footnotes that would be in a lot of our lectures and that sort of thing. They never explained why. I mean, medical school, particularly then, wouldn't want to touch anything that they might see as a even mildly political issue, even though not discussing it made it one, really. You must be annoyed by this. Does this happen to you? Are you like sitting in your lecture class and then like the teacher will mention something about Native Americans and then all like the white students in your class just turn their heads and like look at you to see your response?
That happens sometimes. Yeah.
You're like, what? Listen.
Usually, yeah. I just like find a wall and I stare at it, just anticipating it, just looking in deep thought until it passes.
Right. Smart student. Molly, you're going to add something?
I was going to add to that, Victor, that, yeah, just to highlight the food desert example during COVID, right? The White River Reservation had one grocery store, and during the lockdown, it was only open, you know, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Like, it had really limited hours, and that was their one grocery store for the entire reservation. And so it was just, even, you know, during the pandemic, everything got a little bit worse. But yeah, they have very limited access to healthy foods, for sure.
One thing that I was like recently educated about during a discussion about diabetes prevention was epigenetics. And like I'm a doctor of modern European history, so if I go off the rails at any point, I'm going to rely on one of you three to gently guide me back. But I found that fascinating, the concept of like intergenerational trauma and epigenetics and how that can impact healthcare today. Is that something either of you could explain to listeners who, like me, are relatively ignorant on it?
Hand that to the...
I can take this one, actually. Oh, yeah. Because actually it's interesting because I did an episode recently about the intergenerational trauma of the Persian diaspora after the revolution and how this most recent set of protests sort of reignited this trauma. And excuse me, one of the one of the guests mentioned that there was a study in mice in which they looked at sort of epigenetics of stress response. They had pregnant mice, and they like they would give them the scent of rose blossom or something, and then they'd shock them. And then the mouse would grow to be really fearful of those shocks that are associated with the rose blossom. And then what they noticed was that like the children of the mice would also respond poorly to like that same rose blossom scent, even though they didn't have the exposure to it. And I looked into it. I mean, because the truth of it is, I don't think you can inherit specific phobias. That just doesn't happen. But I kind of pushed back on that point a little bit. And I got a lot of messages from molecular pathologists who were like, so you can't stress during pregnancy. It can affect the DNA. It can affect the DNA, and that can be passed down, changes in the DNA, disruption in the DNA. You can't inherit specific phobias or fears or stresses per se, but it can clearly cause genetic damage when you have that much stress. And then on top of that, of course, we're talking about the psychological impact it has on someone and then how they raise their children and how their children grow up. So it is, I agree, it's a very interesting subject, but I don't want to get any more molecular pathologist emails. Molly, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I'm glad you took this epigenetics question from me.
You know, one thing about you're going back to what you were saying, Victor, about the situations that have sort of predicated this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is most of the land that these Indian reservations are on in the United States, like there's 326, if I read that correctly, is not on great land. It's like land that's like close to like mines or places where there's some sort of radiation or there's some sort of issue. It's not great like for growing food itself directly there. Is that correct? Is that part of this?
Correct. Yeah, I think a lot of it was the intention was to put indigenous peoples on land that wasn't as fertile, and that's kind of goes back into what I was talking about, traditional foods and how it's difficult. But I think, you know, I don't know if the science was all there at the time. And I think now a lot of indigenous land, a lot of reservations, actually they found out that they're on like on top of big mines and like things that the Western world finds really valuable. And so there's a shift almost to almost you see it in like policies and lawsuits today to start trying to grab more minerals from the land that they actually put us on, which they didn't think was valuable. And now they're like, wait, there's like copper under there.
Flat's a good example of that, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, the podcaster and the rapper Propaganda Prop, I'm James, you probably have mm-hmm. met him. Yeah. You know, he speaks about how initially they put the African Americans in the waterfront. They said, here, you're going to live in these places by the ocean where you can't really grow things that well. And then after a while, they realized, oh, no, that's really valuable property. And then they started trying to find ways to get them out of there. It seems to be our national MO. Can we get back to the IHS a little bit? So you guys have mentioned Indian Health Services. It's come up a couple times. And James, I'd also want to hear your, because you've worked there as well. I'd like to hear, like, what are some things that the IHS is doing well? What are some things that need work and how?
I just want to say the IHS, I think they're doing what they can. A lot of it, they're doing what they well with what they have. I would say like a lot of the issues are underfunding and we don't exactly know how well, like we don't really know the potential quite yet because they just don't have enough funding. So I think like, I would just like to insert that caveat into the conversation first. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I only have experience on one reservation and they're, you know, everyone is different for sure. I think someone might know more than me, but the Alaska health system, Indian health system, is still part of the IHS, but it's like kind of its own thing, and they are the kind of the gold standard for, or they are doing the best with what they have. And I don't know, maybe you guys know, James or Victor, that if they have more funding is probably a big part of it, if they just have more funding. But they are kind of touted as the leader in IHS right now.
I know but less about this than either of you, I'm sure, but I know I worked on an NIH grant years ago with someone who'd worked with Alaska Native people, and they were talking about this Promotores de Salud model, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. It came from Oakland, actually, but like it's a peer mentor model for health education that they had implemented there, and we were trying to get money to implement that on the Yaqui Reservation. Didn't work, but shockingly. That model that they use of like using people from the community to educate people from the community rather than like I guess you could call it like white men in white coats worked very well for them, and I think it's a very desirable model to replicate. It's not that expensive either, and we were doing it with diabetes prevention, right? So like chiefly my thing is riding bikes, has been my whole life, and so
hippie.
just a big old bike riding hippie, but like riding bikes is very good for you, as it turns out, which is nice. So the thing that we've been doing with a lot of my friends on the Yaqui Reservation is getting folks, helping them out with a bike and helmet and lights and all the things that you need, teaching them to fix the bike, right, and then having them go ahead and ride the bike, and then like it having them bring friends and family members to come back and ride the bike and have a goal event as part of that. And that's worked very well for us too. So that model that they implemented has been super successful within this very small context of getting Yaqui folks to ride bikes.
Yeah, just going off of that, I mean, that sounds awesome. And I think one of the limitations of the IHS is that it's this huge bureaucracy. So it's hard to do stuff like that. Like, for instance, at the Yaqui tribe, I'm sure, you know, we're not the easiest tribe to work with, but but we're probably easier than the IHS.
Yeah.
Because the IHS, yeah. And I think that's a huge limitation. Like, even if you want to do a study on the IHS, it has to be approved by like all of these government officials and bureaucrats. And I think that makes it really difficult. And especially because, you know, and there's so many branches of the government that the Indian Health Service is just one small, you know, piece of it. And it's not necessarily one that's like heavily prioritized by the government. But there are improvements that are being made. I think in this last appropriations bill, the Indian Health Service got like funded a lot more than it had previously. So hopefully we'll see some improvements. I think they're doing really well when it comes to digital health, the integration of electronic medical systems. I think that made a significant impact when that was introduced. And then...
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You know, I think the Indian Health Service, like the model, does well in giving a lot of freedom to tribes to choose. Do we want to continue with the Indian Health Service, or do we want to take our health system over and run it ourselves, but still use the same money that would have been used anyways? I think that's what a lot of the clinics in Alaska did, in terms of having like, it's called 638 clinic or 638 clinics or tribal health systems. It's really cool what they did in Alaska, because those are some of the most remote villages, you know, in the US. And I think that is something that we should be paying more attention to, especially, you know, when we're talking about, you know, we talk about Alaska, that they're remote, but a lot of tribes in other parts of the US are maybe not as remote, but they're in very similar situations in that they're kind of disconnected, like on food deserts. And I think the same model can be used, but not every tribe is at the place where they're capable yet of taking over like the operations, the staff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and every tribe is kind of in a different place.
I'm interested. I think you were mostly tongue in cheek, but when you mentioned the Yaqui tribe is not that easy to work with, what do you mean? Like, is it is there a lot of different opinions? Is that why? Is it hard to manage, or why would that be difficult?
We're just very militant, and I think we just, you know, we just do our own thing, and
very independent.
And yeah, we're just kind of like, I think we just have a very rebellious nature in us. Like, we're sort of just really headstrong, and like, we don't work on the same timeline, I think, sometimes. It's like when, yeah, for instance, like I'll tell you a story. There was this shrimp farmer dude, one of our traditional spiritual leaders, political leaders. He passed away in early 2000s. His name was Anselmo Valencia, and they were bringing down, they're trying to introduce shrimp farming in the traditional villages in Sonora, Mexico. So they brought this guy all the way down. He's this businessman, and you know, he's running on time. And they brought him down to the traditional authorities in one of the pueblos. And then all of a sudden, right in the middle of the meeting, the snake, you see this snake on the floor go by. And then Anselmo Valencia, he's like, stop, wait for a second. And he grabs the snake and then he looks at it. And he says, we have to stop the meeting. I have to go back to Tucson. And this business guy is like, what the hell, yo, I just came from like Manhattan and I flew all the way. I'm in this village. And like, and they stopped the meeting. And and this guy's like, confused. I think he got really angry, and that never happened to him in a business meeting before. But there was, you know, a traditional aspect that I think we just put that above everything else. Like during, even today during times of ceremony, like no one's answering emails. No tribal government official is going to get back to you within those like 3-4 weeks because they're doing spiritual practices and honoring that. So yeah,
I get it. From my perspective, everyone is lovely, and like, it's nice to have a community where everyone cares about each other and like wants everyone else to be healthy, and like, that's great. There are times when, like, recently we did a live show to raise money to buy more bikes, and someone from iHeart was trying to get a W-9 out of us, and I was like, nah, it's like Easter week, it's not gonna happen. Like, it's just, I did, but it's fine, you explain it. And like, I always attribute, like, I'm not fully culturally fluent, right? Like, I'm a guy from England. Like, it was different where I grew up. So like, things.
Are you not Yaqui?
you couldn't tell. Yeah, stout is it's right up there with Valencia. I don't have full cultural fluency, so it's on me to kind of listen and learn over time, rather than be frustrated and bulldoze shit.
Well, you're obviously very good at that, in my opinion, from what I've seen from you so far. But I'm very curious, actually, from both James and Molly, like, when you guys first started going to the reservation, what surprised you? What was different than you had envisioned? What, you know, because I'm assuming you got all your knowledge of what reservations were like, from Hollywood, like I did, you know. Mm-hmm. What was fact? What was fiction?
It was my first time like on a reservation. And I think it was, it sort of felt like a little bit of a different, country almost. Like, you're in Arizona and you drive 3 hours and you feel like you're in a really different place. It feels just a little bit different. It's beautiful. The one I'm on was, or the one that I went to, is in White River, Arizona. It really is beautiful in the mountains, along a river, but it's, you know, a lot of single story housing, that are all kind of government cookie cutter housing. And I got to kind of go into the homes too, when we were doing house visits. So that felt, I felt very like privileged, and it felt special to be able to do that. as a very foreign person, right? I felt like an outsider. And yeah, I mean, there's not central heat for some of these houses. Lots of the floors were dirt, like not actual flooring on the houses. So that was, I think, surprising to me, because it seems like that is not something you think of when you think of America. But that probably was like the most surprising. But then like the street dogs running around everywhere was kind of classic. I think that my first drive down, I like had to stop because like a pack of dogs went by, and that was kind of out of a movie.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, obviously I'm not American either. Yeah, it's shocking. I actually am. I'm from Texas. I just watched the Harry Potter films on repeat. That's how I learned to be a TERF. I'm not a TERF.
I don't think that needs to be said. I think we knew that, but go on.
Yeah, those people should go away. I didn't maybe receive a lot of that, like, sort of ingrained kind of... Like, I'm British, but we fucking did settler colonialism everywhere. I don't want to erase that for a second. I would just go to the res to ride my bike through it. Pascualiaki Res has nice roads, lovely bike lanes. And it's much smaller than like the Tohono O'odham Res, which is next door. That's the size of Connecticut for people who aren't familiar. And I'm from a part of England that's very rural, where people talk to each other. And that's the thing that I don't like about living in a town in California, is that everyone just kind of lives in a little box and kind of moves around and doesn't talk to each other. And I, at least in my experience on the reservation, everyone is friendly and nice. Most of the people I run into are friendly and nice. And so I really like that. First guy I ran into was a traditional artist, David Moreno, who runs an art program there. He's a very lovely guy. We just were chatting, I think. I was trying to encourage him to come on a bike ride with me. And like, he didn't have a bike. So then I was just trying to encourage, like, I was like, maybe I could get some bikes and come back. And I spoke to some people in diabetes prevention and we got some bikes and came back. But obviously people's houses aren't super duper fancy, but they're fine. Like, people have some nice houses on the res. I didn't grow up in a super fancy house, and like, it's the houses that are not that distinct from those that I see in San Diego. It's beautiful too, like, especially down, if you go on the O'odham reservation further down. We did a ride there in 2019, and we went out the night before from the Yaqui reservation with a group of us, and we did like a big camp out. And then we did a ride the next day. Their roads are not quite as nice as the Yaqui roads. We ran out of inner tubes because everyone got so many punctures. But like, it's beautiful landscape. It's really gorgeous. I think the biggest shock to me was the donkeys. The donkeys on the O'odham Res are something else. Like, just wild ass donkeys that like, at night it sounds like there's a murder occurring, because it just make these horrendous noises. And like, you puncture on your bike and you go for a little bit of shade because it's very hot, and suddenly you realize there are like 10 bulls like just chilling there too. So that was the weirdest thing. But like, I don't know, people shouldn't just walk onto reservations and start like trying to have their cultural immersion experience or whatever. That's a bit cringe. But people equally shouldn't think that it's a scary or different or dangerous place. Like, Arizona feels foreign to me. Like, I go to Phoenix and that mm-hmm. that is a scary experience for other reasons. I've always felt very welcome and comfortable there.
Yeah, if I can just add one more thing. Oh, sorry. Just, I think the other, that's a great point, James, but like, the striking part for me too is that I felt very welcomed when I was there. And they like have a very soft way of speaking, and I'm like a loud, annoying American, and so like are obviously they're American as well, but I've kind of a loud voice, and they're very soft spoken and so gentle and so just like appreciative. And I kind of, for me, I was like, wow, this is like amazing that you have the resiliency to feel appreciative when like I don't feel like you should, you know, feel grateful or appreciative to me. I thought that was like my the most striking that I felt.
Molly's so nice. She's like trying to apologize for being, listen, you're talking to two podcasters. We're like, obnoxious is our nature. It's like part of our DNA and why we do this. You don't need to explain yourself there. Victor, you've already touched on this a little bit, but do you find yourself still dispelling myths and stereotypes about Native Americans, even at medical school?
Yeah, all the time. You know, we talked about the medical misconceptions and those things, but I think like I said, I feel like the American educational system, it left so much room for interpretation, and what it did give was, you know, a lot of it wasn't true. But I think what I'm really battling is that people just, the level of exposure they have is so minimal that they're coming into these conversations and discussions with pretty much almost nothing. And so the average American knows very, very little about Native Americans. And when I say that, I don't mean Native American culture, because I don't think any Native American really cares if they know our culture or not. In fact, they might even protect it. But we're talking about what is the experience of Native Americans in this country? What happened? What were the policies? What are the issues that are still going on today? You know, there's the level of education, it's just not to the point where I find we can even have these discussions, the discussions that we need to have. So I think the most taxing thing on me is that whenever I talk about Indigenous experiences or anything related to Indigenous health, I have to give so much background that every time I have to educate someone on, you know, what is colonization, what happened, and the very basics of I think that should be basic in this country, all these basics. And by that time, you know, I think people have gotten so much information that maybe they didn't know before. They get overwhelmed, and these things can also be very touchy subjects. I think because we haven't been bold enough in the U.S. to actually just talk about them, and I think people, you know, might be a little afraid to acknowledge these things and somewhere inside. And I think what would have helped with that is if they were, you know, exposed to it in, you know, starting in elementary school history, starting in middle school, high school, all of these things. I think we need to start doing that in the educational system if we're really going to make progress.
Yeah. As like someone who teaches history, has taught history, I think that's very true. And sadly, it's only getting worse, like places like Florida, right, are making it harder and harder to talk about that. But I think when people come, certainly, so like I teach a community college course, an American history course. And I think when people come to that course, I'm in California, like many of them, for instance, could not name the tribe whose like ancestral and current homelands they are sitting in and learning. And then obviously, to understand those experiences, you have to have a name for them, right? And if you don't have a name for the people, then you're a long way from understanding, I guess. But it's something that's still desperately lacking in the American education system, and it doesn't seem like people are pushing hard enough to get that rectified. Like it's a very big gap. Even in places, you know, like you could be at school in Arizona, like you could be an hour from some of the biggest reservations in the United States, right? The Autumn and the Navajo, maybe not an hour. Everything's a long way away in Arizona, but and not understand anything about those people's lived experience if you're in Scottsdale.
Yeah, in the Bay Area, I've grown up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I knew very little about the Native people that were here until one of my oldest son had to do a project here in San Francisco on the Miwok tribe. And then only then did I learn, oh my God, they were everywhere here. You know, there's so much of the Ohlone tribe. So even here, you know, which is a relatively progressive, not Floridian system, you know, did I not learn a lot about that? But I also, Victor, I also hear you, like, I know it must be exhausting. And we appreciate you coming on to talk to us about it. James and I have talked about this before. It's something that I at least grapple with sometimes, like in terms of like bringing on guests, you know, like I want people to talk about these things that are difficult and sometimes maybe even a little traumatic to like talk about. But there's this balance of like, well, I want the people who've experienced it know the most about it to speak about it, but also don't want to keep re-exposing people to like the same exhausting trauma every time. You know, it becomes a tough thing for me at least to figure out and balance, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think, you know, these podcasts are a great way to do that, to have these discussions, because it actually, I think it takes away from the taxation, because it hits a lot of people at once, you know,
you know, listeners in the tens. We have listeners in the tens, Victor.
Yeah, that's much better.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do a QR code so you can just be like, hey, check this out.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Colleagues.
So Victor, I'm sorry. I have one last question for you. You know, you mentioned that you want to go back and practice on the reservation, be a part of the community again. Do you plan on bringing in traditional healing components to your practice? And if so, are you going to do specialty training? Is there like a version of a fellowship that you will do for that?
Yeah, I really want to do traditional practices. I'm not a traditional healer myself, but I want to partner with them. I feel like I have the connections to traditional people to do stuff like that. One of the things like I really want to do is try to do a lot of public health initiatives out of my practice. Like, for instance, I want to try to find ways to help people grow their own food, start their own gardens, do community gardens. I really want to get our traditional foods up and running again. And there's a lot of people already working on this, which is amazing. I just want to be of service to that effort. And I think that is one of the most important things right now. I also really want to do like public health initiatives around language revitalization. Mm-hmm. I think language is so important when it comes to the mental health of Indigenous youth. I believe that Indigenous youth who know how to speak their language are more mentally strong during the continuing tides of colonization that they face in this Western world. If they have their language, I think that's huge in terms of resilience. As culture as well, I think, you know, finding ways to sort of support culture as medicine, culture as prevention, participating in ceremonies as, you know, making it, you know, very apparent that to your audience and to the world that is protective of Indigenous health, Indigenous mental health. And so, you know, there's all these facets of traditional ways of life that were all very healthy to us. And I think a huge part of the battle is that we're still having right now because of colonization is revitalizing those things. And then those things, you know, the more that they're revitalized, the more that we decolonize, the healthier we're going to be. But at the same time, recognizing that Western medicine can also be very effective too, if it's just properly funded and if the service is effective. And so that's the other side of the coin that I want to be working on as well.
Oh, excellent, man.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to touch on before we finish is, because it seems relatively current and newsy, right, is, and I think Victor made an excellent point that like colonization isn't a thing that stopped. It's a thing that we keep doing. Not we, including Victor, but, you know, like we, people like me. The Indian Child Welfare Act, right, ICWA, is a thing that the Supreme Court is like set up to take a swing at. And I know that is an area of great concern to many people. And I was just in a tribal building last week looking at books for Yaqui children, right, to help them stay connected with their culture if they're in a family which is not a tribal family. Can you, if you feel comfortable, explain what ICWA is and then the damage it does to young people to be pulled away from their culture and sort of like this little act of colonization that happens every time that happens.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because colonization is definitely continuing. For instance, we think about the Black Hills in South Dakota and the gold mining, the gold rush there. Well, there's still dozens of gold mining permits that are pending right now in the Black Hills. There are dozens of gold mines still operating there, and the Lakota and Dakota are still fighting for the Black Hills. That's just one instance, but you see that all across the United States. And I think when it comes to the Indian Child Welfare Act, that's another really good example. So basically, the Indian Child Welfare Act, if a Native child is in the foster care system, it helps to support those children to find a placement with a family who is from their tribe, from their cultural background. And the reasoning behind that is because to stop the history of assimilation when it comes to taking Native children from their families. And we know about that, you know, through the U.S. boarding school system. That was one example, but it kind of transitioned at a point once boarding schools were terminated, those forced boarding schools, it kind of transitioned into the foster care system. And at one point, a huge proportion of Native children were in foster care, and they were being placed with white families. And those white families were not exposing them to their cultural background. And that in itself was potentiating assimilation, because that's another Native child, dozens of Native children, thousands of Native children who don't know their language, their culture, because they've been removed from community due to systemic factors, right? And so this bill, it doesn't say, oh, you can only go with a Native family. It helps to ensure that if there is a suitable Native family from their tribe, that they will get first priority, because they know that culture is also very important to Indigenous child well-being as well. So the battle right now is being brought on by this lawsuit that primarily handles like mining and oil companies, but they're taking this Indian Child Welfare Act lawsuit pro bono, because if you can get rid of the Indian Child Welfare Act on the basis that they're claiming it's racism, right? They're claiming that Native people are getting some unjust preferential treatment when it comes to adopting Native children over white people on the basis of race. Where that falls short is that the basis of the Indian Child Welfare Act is that Indigenous peoples are not a race. They're sovereign nations. They have a political status distinct from any other race in the US. And that is the basis that tribes are arguing for, that, hey, we have this political status. We're a tribal government. We have the rights to raise our children. We have the rights to teach our children, to make sure they grow up in community with our culture. That's not a race issue. That's a political issue. That relates to our political status as a tribal nation, as a sovereign nation. And so they're going to be battling that in court. But if the Supreme Court decides that this Indian Child Welfare Act is, you know, racist or discriminatory based on race, it means that a number of other bills, of other things in the law that for instance, that exist due to the political status of Indigenous nations, have the potential to also be thrown out on the basis of racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, will lead to a lot more land grabs, a lot less services being provided. For instance, like the Indian Health Service, for instance, they might say, oh, why do Native Americans get this health care? Yeah, they might start taking down a whole bunch of other things that are really important to us. So it's really, it's a huge issue right now.
It's a troubling time, and I could see how people in the past might have said, oh, don't worry, that won't happen. I think it's pretty clear that these things can happen pretty quickly, pretty aggressively now. I think the last couple of years have shown a lot of people that things can get worse somehow, you know, and that these things can be taken, more and more can be taken from people that have already had so much taken from them. So
I guess I like to finish off normally, instead of just being like, here is some sad shit and just pointing to it and then kind of like dropping the mic, asking people how they can do something to stand in solidarity. So like, if either of you want to mention, I know there's Bears Ears, Oak Flat, there are other attempts to expropriate and colonize indigenous land and sacred spaces, a fucking border wall is bulldozing Kumeyaay graveyards, like as I'm talking to you. Are there ways that people can stand in solidarity with indigenous communities?
I'll go first because Victor will have a better answer than me, and he can jump in after me. But I think as like a low level entry thing that people can do, and it kind of touches on how trying to remove the burden on asking for education and doing the education yourself, for that white people can do, is just, you can read books by Native authors, and that teaches you a lot of history. And there's like some incredible Native authors who are writing beautiful stories that are weaved with fact and fiction, but books, and then like Native media. Reservation Dogs is like a TV show on Hulu that is a really great show that everyone should watch. So I think you can do some like easy things that just remove some of the needing to be taught to on yourselves, and you can just learn about what we're missing. So those are like very, very easy. And then in terms of like, just from my point of view as an ND, there are a lot of ways to get involved, because these the reservations are chronically understaffed. They're just like rural medicine, IHS or not IHS, rural medicine is very understaffed in our country. And so there's always opportunities for doctors to go and work, and it's like valuable and amazing for us and for the community to be able to do. So there are ways to do that through locum companies and directly through the IHS sites.
Victor?
I think conversation, you know, I would love if white allies would talk to their family members and their friends. And I think there are a lot of moments where in these day-to-day personal interactions, when natives might come up to stand up, like if you hear something that is ignorant, you hear something that might be racist, to stand up to the people that you know in your own circles and say, hey, no, that's not correct. To talk to your friends and family about what you learned with regard to colonization or the issues that Native American people face. Because I think some of the people that we listen to the most are the people that we love, our friends and our family. And I think there needs to be a lot more conversation in those spaces, a lot more accountability, because I know that it can be very hard when difficult things come up in those personal interactions to challenge someone. But I think that is where that sort of thing can really move the needle in the long run. And I think that sometimes people just choose to stay silent. And I would like that to change.
Yeah, very well said. That seems like a fantastic place to close it here. Thank you both so much for coming on and hanging out with us. You've been listening to The House of Pod and It Could Happen Here. Let's get some plugs in for you guys. Can you, let's start with you, Victor. Tell us where people can find you, or plug anything you want to plug.
Come to the res. Just ask for me.
Original Facebook.
Yeah.
My Instagram and Twitter are Velo Carmen, VLOCARMEN.
Very cool. And Molly.
I exited the Twitter sphere after Elon Musk took over, so I'm off. But you can find me in Sacramento.
All right, you guys have been so awesome. Thank you both for coming on. We hope to talk again sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.